The granddad who wasn't the granddad who wasn't. September 2016, John Barrett was never the boy's grandfather in any official sense, but you'd never have known it. Remy called him granddad with the kind of joy that made the word sacred, and John, gruff, sea-weathered John, would soften completely, his face glowing like a hearth fire lit against the chill. That title hadn't come from blood, it came from love. It was a title their biological grandfather, Ron, had never earned. Ron had always been a shadow, drifting in and out of our lives with the substance of smoke. Only once had he shown up when it truly mattered, at Sally's funeral, October 26, 1998. Grief made him look smaller than he was, hunched beside his daughter's grave like a man trying to vanish into the earth with her. Yet, in that moment, he offered something, a sliver of hope. "I'll take the boys out for pizza next week in Tunbridge Wells," he'd said. A modest gesture, a thin olive branch. But when the day drew close, it wasn't Ron who called. It was Norma, his new girlfriend. Her voice was breezy, almost casual. "Ron's got a cold. He won't be able to make it this Saturday." I responded with more grace than I felt. Told her to give him my regards and let us know when he was well enough to reschedule. That call never came. Neither she nor Ron ever reached out again. Years later, Remy, older now, but not quite hardened, decided to find them. He tracked down a number. Norma answered. Her tone was cold, clipped. She offered no warmth, no welcome. The conversation was short. The door slammed shut, this time with finality. We all understood then what we'd always suspected. Ron didn't want the boys. Just as he'd kept Sally at arm's length through most of her life, he would stay absent from theirs. He had made his choice. And once Norma entered the picture, he'd slipped back into silence as easily as a man slipping into an old coat. John, though, John was the opposite of all that. He was present, loyal, deeply kind. A sailor by trade, he had spent decades at sea, crossing vast oceans and unknown harbors. He'd never married, never had children of his own. When the boys entered his life, they filled a quiet space he hadn't even known was empty. He loved Barbara with a kind of unflinching devotion, despite being 25 years her junior. His family back in Thorn disapproved. They made no secret of it, but John didn't flinch. I never met them. I was never invited into that part of his life, but I could tell their judgment stung him. When John died in 2016, a tidal wave of regret crashed over me. We hadn't seen them enough. After Sally passed, Barbara and John used to visit often. Barbara retired, stayed for long stretches to help with the boys. John, still working, came when he could, but that changed after a single sour moment. Diane had come to the house to meet them for the first time. She knocked gently. John answered. She smiled and offered her hand. "Hi, I'm Diane," he eyed her, expression unreadable. "You the bag lady?" Diane blinked, caught off guard. "No, I'm Ason's girlfriend." The room iced over. Barbara was no warmer. She didn't hide her mistrust. Her questions about Diane were sharp, deliberate. What were her intentions? Did she care about the boys? About me? But I didn't hold it against Barbara. I couldn't, because I understood, deep down I agreed. It wasn't about Diane, not really. It wouldn't have mattered who stood at that door. No one could ever measure up to Sally. Not in Barbara's eyes, not in mine either, if I was honest. Her cynicism wasn't cruelty, it was loyalty. A silent, unspoken vow. Sally was irreplaceable. After that, the visit stopped. Now, we were returning north, this time for John's funeral. Ben was 29, Remy 28, Josh 22, no longer boys. Men with jobs, responsibilities, distractions. But this wasn't optional. I told them we were going. We owed John that much. The drive up was quiet, familiar roads, M1, M18, into Goole through the stretch of old industrial land. We hadn't been back in years. I still spoke to Barbara, but our calls were stiff, laced with subtext. She always asked if Diane and I were still together, sounding strangely pleased when we weren't, and pointedly quiet when we were. When I sold Old Road, she was livid. That house was full of Sally's ghost. Barbara had helped furnish it, paint it, make it a home. Letting it go felt, to her, like erasing a sacred shrine. I don't think she ever forgave me. Remy didn't either. We weren't invited to stay with her. No surprise there. I booked us into the Lowther Hotel. Elegant enough, walking distance to her house. We dropped our bags and headed straight to hers. Barbara opened the door with genuine joy in her eyes. Her Yorkshire Terrier, Charlie, was less welcoming, yapping, nipping, full of fury. He bit straight through my sock, blood dotting the fabric. I didn't say a word. Barbara was mortified. Ben lifted the dog into his arms, and instantly Charlie melted, licking his hands, tail wagging. But when Josh reached over to pet him, Charlie bared his teeth, growling like a tiny demon. Only Ben had the magic touch. We settled in the living room, full of old warmth and quiet ghosts. We talked about John, his humor, his stoicism, the way he'd quietly saved us all in different ways. Barbara asked about the boys, about me, about Diane. I told her the truth. We were doing well. I had franchised the business. I explained what that meant. She listened with a blank expression. I couldn't tell if she was impressed or indifferent, but that same mistrust never left her eyes. We said our goodbyes early, 8:30 the next morning, she reminded us. The procession would leave at 9 sharp. Back at the hotel, the receptionist, a young man in his 20s, did a double take when he saw Remy. Turns out they'd gone to university together in Liverpool. Now he was back in Goole, working and living at home. That familiar face brought perks, heavy drink discounts on already cheap drinks. The boys were thrilled. I was wary. Before heading to bed, I left them with clear instructions. No all-nighters, no nonsense. Breakfast at 7:30, funeral at 9, non-negotiable. The next morning, I was downstairs at 7:45, suited and ready, alone, no sign of them. By 8, my blood boiled. I stomped upstairs and pounded on Ben's door. He opened it, dazed, eyes bloodshot, hair like he'd wrestled a pillow all night, still in boxers. "What the hell are you doing?" I hissed. "Get dressed, now." No answer. He looked at me like a child caught stealing. Next door, I banged again. No response. When the door finally creaked open, I was hit by the thick, unmistakable stench of weed. My chest tightened. My fury roared to life. They'd been up all night, drinking, smoking, laughing, disrespecting the one reason we were even here. We made it to Barbara's just in time. The house was full. Old faces, new strangers. Charlie, locked upstairs, barked like mad, his high-pitched yelps bouncing off the walls, a soundtrack of chaos beneath the grief. The eulogies were beautiful, simple, honest. Someone mentioned John's sarcastic streak, and I smiled, remembering his very first words to Diane, "You the bag lady?" Later, at the church hall, my phone buzzed. It was the hotel. They were furious. The boys had been caught smoking weed on the premises. Guests had complained. Staff were appalled. Effective immediately, we were banned. There I was, trying to mourn, trying to hold the memory of a good man together, and my sons had dragged our name through the mud. I said nothing, but inside I burned. I blamed Ramey, loudly, repeatedly, unfairly, as I would come to learn. At the wake, Ramey curled up in a corner, half asleep, disinterested. I was ashamed. Silently, I paid the full catering bill, my final tribute to John. Later, John's brother Stephen sought me out, clasped my hand. "Thank you," he said. "That meant a lot." That night, I returned to the hotel alone and begged the manager to let us stay just one more night. After much groveling, they agreed. Barely. The next day, we had lunch with Barbara at the old hotel she and John loved. It was gentle, quiet, healing in its own way. Later, I confronted the boys, told them they had dishonored the memory of someone who had never asked anything from them but love. I aimed my fury at Remy. Only much later did I learn it was Ben's weed. But by then, the damage was done. The car was packed. We were ready to leave. I hugged Barbara tightly, promising to visit more often. Remy, ever the optimist, piped up, "You should come down to Lewisham. Stay with us." I turned and shot him a look sharp enough to cut. He was oblivious. Or maybe not. Maybe he knew and said it anyway, defiantly hopeful. But Diane would never allow it. Not in a million years. Barbara's smile was quiet, almost sorrowful. "Thank you, Remy," she said, her voice a thread of grace. "But my home is here." And with that, we drove away, back down south, the silence in the car thick with the things we didn't say.